The tax bill's done, yes tis. The selling of the tax bill? Ooh, that's just getting started. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, 21 December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, the tax bill has passed Congress, and yes, the president is going to sign it right after New Year's, probably. But the idea that now all has been said and done? Nah. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor explains what's coming.
If you thought slash prayed that you wouldn't have to hear about the tax debate anymore, think again, friend.
Thank you for cutting my taxes.
Thank you for fixing our economy.
Thank you for keeping my family safe.
Thank you for putting America first.
That's part of a pro-tax bill ad campaign that'll be launched Christmas Day by conservative group America First Policies. And on the other side, groups like the Not One Penny campaign plan on spending $10 million next year on ads like these.
It adds $1.4 trillion to the deficit, all to pay for huge tax breaks for the super wealthy and big corporations.
Why all this effort on a tax plan that will have already passed?
The advertising before a piece of legislation is intended to shape legislator opinions and decisions, and the advertising afterwards is aimed at the public as they head into the midterm elections.
Erica Franklin Fowler directs the Wesleyan Media Project. It is all about the midterms. Nicole Gill runs the anti-tax bill Not One Penny campaign.
Well, our whole purpose behind the campaign is to hold members accountable.
Republicans, meanwhile, want to take credit for their signature accomplishment. They may be fighting an uphill battle.
It's very difficult to influence public opinion.
Jeffrey Berry is professor of political science at Tufts. People, he says, already have a first impression of the tax bill, and polls show it's generally not a good impression.
They then begin to look for information that confirms that first impression, not for information that contradicts it.
But Republicans do need to try. Franklin Fowler says look no further than the passage of Obamacare for a lesson on that.
The Democrats really did not sell Obamacare after they passed it, whereas Republicans really capitalized on it as a campaign point.
History repeats itself, and so will the ads. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Today's dose of corporate news comes to us out of Vevey, Switzerland. Not a run-of-the-mill dateline on this program, I know, but it does happen to be the global headquarters of the Swiss conglomerate Nestle, famous for its milk chocolate, of course, among many other things. Nestle announced today it's getting out of the American candy game. By the first quarter of next year, the company plans to sell its American confectionery division, perhaps because it's trailed its competitors in that field, like Hershey, for years. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Nestle's been talking about getting out of the U.S. candy market since the summer, when it started shopping around brands like Butterfinger and Crunch Bar. It's all part of the new CEO's strategy to divest and get rid of parts of the company that are struggling. Douglas Yu is a business correspondent at confectionerynews.com. He says the candy market in America has been flat for years.
A lot of consumers are moving towards healthy snacking, portion control, on-the-go, low-calorie, low-sugar.
Like it's bottled water, or it's Gerber baby food, or the new Atrium vitamin company it just bought. But Nestle says the plans to sell its American confectionery are more about profit than moving away from less healthy snacks. It wants to push its brands that make the most money. And in the U.S., that's not candy.
Nestle's not going anywhere because it has this reputation out there. Nestle's is a power brand by itself, but I think they're just shifting their business focus to something that they think they can be in a dominant position in the marketplace.
Those Nestle candy brands that we're all familiar with, like Baby Ruth and Laffy Taffy, are probably not going anywhere, says Bernard Pasiniak. He's editor-in-chief of Candy Industry Magazine. He says the brands just need a new strategy.
A company that's willing to put some money behind them, you know, can resurrect them, can make them, you know, very profitable, maybe by appealing to millennials in a different fashion. They have a lot of potential.
Hershey's is a likely target to acquire the company, but it just spent $1.6 billion on a popcorn and chip business. There's also talk that Nestle could sell individual brands, your Raisinets, Smarties, Goobers, to a host of different companies. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
What about Nestle Crunch? Andy, no love for Nestle Crunch? That was my go-to when I was a kid. Tax bill has passed. Yes, the government is not going to shut down till mid-January anyway. And yet, there was a distinct lack of enthusiasm amongst traders today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. congressional hearing is a staple of this televised political age. There are hundreds of them every single year. In the first 6 months of 2017, almost 700 hearings in the House alone were broadcast, webcast, and archived. Some of them attracted crowds that lined up hours before the doors opened just to be in the room. But considering the most hearings aren't quite must-see TV, and nearly all of them are live-streamed or on C-SPAN, why bother showing up? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains there is more to a hearing than meets the eye.
It's 10 a.m. on a chilly Tuesday in December. The Senate Banking Committee has come together to vote on whether to exempt smaller banks from some of the regulations in the Dodd-Frank financial reform law.
If we learned anything from the financial crisis, it's that deregulation of the banks doesn't create economic growth.
The usual suspects are in their usual seats. That was Senator Sherrod Brown, you just heard. Michael Crapo, Bob Corker, Elizabeth Warren are all up on the dais behind the microphones. The hearing room is packed. C-SPAN is rolling. It's easy to get the idea that today's important work will take place on that dais. But there's a whole other system of power and influence operating in this hearing room in the audience that C-SPAN doesn't see. Bart Naylor, a lobbyist for the watchdog group Public Citizen, slips out of the proceedings and gives me a report. Naylor goes to several hearings a week. He's been working this hearing for the past 2 hours. Public Citizen doesn't want bank regulations rolled back.
I'm in communication as we speak with various staffers about amendments that are being proposed.
That's Naylor's understated way of saying he's in the room, and he's been tweeting and emailing nonstop since the hearing began, jumping on comments that help the cause, like this one from Hawaii Democrat Brian Schatz. Schatz is upset with fellow Democrats for siding with Republicans when Schatz says,
"What a shame that in the United States Senate, the one place we can find room for bipartisanship is to give relief for financial institutions."
With that, Naylor tweets out,
"Senator Schatz, what a shame that the one area where we can achieve bipartisanship is on making banks more profitable."
Did you catch that? Schatz's giving relief turned into Naylor's making banks more profitable. Naylor's also emailing the Senate staffers sitting behind their bosses on the dais alerts like, what do you need? Something to fire up the grassroots? Retweets? Not so long ago, Lee Drutman was one of those staffers on the dais. He says,
"Hearings today are almost like theater. And it's the lobbyists who are the directors and the producers behind the scenes."
Drutman now researches lobbying at the think tank New America. He says lobbyists also often write the questions lawmakers ask witnesses. They help choose the witnesses. And those lobbyists are frequently in the room, in full view of those committee members up on the dais.
And who's there is a powerful signal to you as to who actually cares about this.
There's also an audience outside the room. And if a member of Congress gives a memorable performance, it can go viral, like when California Democrat Maxine Waters took Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin to task.
"Reclaiming my time, would you please explain the rules and do not take that away from my time."
Or when Republican Senator Orrin Hatch had heard enough about how the Republican tax plan is geared toward the rich.
"So don't spew that stuff on me. I get a little tired of that crap."
If you're a congressional aide up on the dais, you just want to fade into the background as you slip suggested questions from lobbyists to your bosses. Mika Ouyang is with the think tank Third Way. She worked for Senator Ted Kennedy in the early 2000s, sitting behind him at televised hearings.
"It's really hard sometimes not to roll your eyes."
Ouyang says it was a relief when Kennedy would attend closed-door hearings with no cameras, no manufactured drama.
"And there you really see members much more interested in getting answers from the witnesses as opposed to making their own statements."
On days like those, the influence ecosystem relocates to the hallway, where lobbyists can buttonhole members of Congress when they finally come out of the hearing room. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
For a long time, like decades, the United States did supercomputers better than anybody else, computers that are zillions of times more powerful than our laptops and our desktops. Times, however, change, and now there is serious competition in supercomputers from the Chinese. According to the latest ranking of the top 500 supercomputers, China has 40% of them, the United States less than a third. Our China correspondent, Jennifer Pack, went to visit the number one fastest supercomputer in the eastern Chinese city of Wuxi.
The world's fastest supercomputer looks like a series of sleek black lockers stored in a room the size of two basketball courts. In English, it's called the Sunway Taihu Light. In Chinese, Shenwei, or divine power.
This supercomputer has a peak performance of 100 petaflops.
How fast is that? Gan Lin, who heads up research here, gave this example.
If all 7 billion people on Earth had a hand calculator, they'd take 32 years to do the same number of calculations this supercomputer can do in 1 minute.
That's five times faster than the top U.S. machine. Supercomputers already help with complex stuff like predicting the weather, analyzing earthquakes, or finding oil and gas deposits. A quicker machine like the Sunway Taihu Light could do even more. Gan Lin says, suppose a company wanted to build a wind farm. It would need to know where the strongest wind energy is. That calculation used to take 3 months in China. With the Sunway Taihu Light, it only takes a week. Armed with that information, a company could be generating energy before its competitors.
If our supercomputer can calculate faster, then our country's industries will be more competitive globally.
Having speedy supercomputers is one thing, but the key component of the machines is still designed by the U.S., says Gan Lin.
Many of our machines are still running on U.S. chipsets.
Chipsets are kind of like the brain of a supercomputer. American companies like Intel and NVIDIA supply almost all of them. That means if the U.S. government perceives a strategic threat, it could potentially curb another country's supercomputing power. In 2015, the U.S. blocked American companies from selling a number of chipsets to China, fearing that the Chinese were using them to develop nuclear weapons. China responded by improving the technology in its own supercomputers.
Some of the fastest ones we're talking about now are based on chipsets that are designed and manufactured in China. So that's a remarkable transition.
Eric Isaacs is the former head of the Department of Energy's Argonne National Lab, which runs one of the top U.S. supercomputers. He identifies another important aspect of supercomputing technology. And he says the U.S. has an advantage here. America designs better software, which is how a company like Boeing created new material to build its planes. And more businesses are becoming reliant on fast supercomputers, says Steve Conway with market research firm Hyperion.
Industries that depend today on supercomputing make up 55% of U.S. gross domestic product.
To stay in the lead, he says the U.S. government needs to increase the amount it invests in research and development. Because if the U.S. is behind on supercomputing, the American economy could suffer too. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I decided some years back that I was going to work really hard half my life, not quite work as hard the other half.
Speaking my language there, man. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 55 points today, about 0.2%, 24,782. The NASDAQ up 4, less than 0.1%, 69.65. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about 0.2%, 26.84. Told you about Nestle, the maker of Butterfinger and Nestle's Crunch. Hello is getting out of the U.S. candy business. Nestle up 1% today. Competitor Hershey kissed 0.25% goodbye. Getting kissed 0.25%? That's pretty good. Cadbury owner Mondelez International boosted 0.3%. The FCC proposed a $13.5 million fine against TV station owner Sinclair Broadcasting today. That's for failing to identify paid programming as advertising. Sinclair clicked down 0.4%. We're telling you that because the broadcaster is waiting for regulatory approval to take over Tribune Media. They were off about 0.1% today. Bond prices, well, they were up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace. December 31st is coming up fast, and that means time is running out to make your tax-deductible donation to support Marketplace. We're all about making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives and raising economic intelligence in a big way. It's important work that we are already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do even more of it. So now is the time. Go to marketplace.org and make a gift in any amount to become a marketplace investor today. And thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's been a little dip in the Bitcoin market this week, a 10% or so drop in the price of the cryptocurrency against the dollar. Of course, that's in the face of a 1,700% rise in the past year, so those tulip bulb analogies still apply. Current price, about $15,700. Per. Speculators, though, investors, if you prefer, are only one side of the Bitcoin equation. The way this thing works is that Bitcoin have to be mined, generated really in a way, with computers doing mathematical calculations that are used to further verify Bitcoin transactions. The BBC's Asia business correspondent Karishma Vaswani visited some Bitcoin miners in Singapore.
In an industrial complex tucked away in a quiet corner of Singapore, a cryptocurrency revolution may be underway. With pop music blaring from the speakers and set in an old warehouse, it's the new sweatshop of the future.
That sound that you hear in the background, those are fans, dozens of fans all over this workshop that are being used to cool these powerful computer units. All around me, I can see dozens of these rigs made up of graphic computer cards. This company only started at the beginning of this year. They say their initial investment has been recovered and the demand for their products has been exponential.
We do cryptocurrency mining.
Dexter Ung is the man in charge. He makes and sells cryptocurrency rigs. They're powerful computers that solve complex mathematical problems, a process through which their owners earn digital currencies.
Because it's getting more and more popular, and with more countries like Japan has already fully legalized Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, more people are investing inside the coins.
So can you tell me how long, Adrian, you've been investing in Bitcoin for?
Turning 6 months now. Started July.
At a Bitcoin ATM in Singapore, I met Adrian, a buyer of the digital currency. He wouldn't tell me his last name, though, because he didn't want his employer to know he was investing.
Aren't you worried about the risks?
What kind of risk? So what I'm risking right now is just the money that I want to risk. I'm not investing my entire savings on it. I'm just trying to understand how it works.
But there are plenty of risks. A lot of the demand for Bitcoin has come from countries in Asia, Japan, South Korea, and China. But Beijing and a whole host of other Asian countries have either banned or considered banning cryptocurrencies, and more are expected to crack down on crypto in the future, increasing volatility in the market.
We've seen a massive run-up. So anybody putting in money today has to have the ability to withstand massive downside volatility.
Dheeraj Barwani is an independent wealth strategist based in Singapore and recently has been advising his clients on investing in cryptocurrencies.
The quick money has clearly been made. If you're getting in here, you have to have a longer term time horizon. It's not going to be measured in months. It's going to be measured in years. And finally, again, these are your investing in early stage unproven technologies, which have a lot of potential. But right now, they're unproven.
Still, that's not stopping some businesses from cashing in on the crypto craze. At this bar in Singapore, customers can pay for their drinks using Ethereum, another popular and increasingly expensive digital currency. For now, it makes up only 2% of transactions, but club owners expect that to grow. Don't pop open the champagne yet, though. Cryptos may well be worth less than a cocktail in the future.
The BBC's Karishma Vaswani, she was in Singapore for us. If you've done any of your gift shopping at Amazon this year, there's a pretty good chance some of those orders were handled by seasonal workers. This year, the company hired more than 120,000 of them for jobs at its fulfillment centers around the country. And for the past couple of years, Amazon's been recruiting a particular kind of migrant worker, I guess you could call them. They're known as work campers, people who live and travel in RVs around the country picking up odd jobs along the way. And that gets us to our latest installment of our seasonal series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Marketplace's Amy Scott, headed to Campbellsville, Kentucky. That's south of Louisville, to check it out.
Okay. Go, Maggie. Go first. Come on in.
It's one of the first really cold nights of December, but the Green River Stables campground is still packed with RVs. The one decked out with blue Christmas lights belongs to Steve and Karen Swayze from Paris, Tennessee. Inside, there's a gas fireplace and a big screen TV. Steve cracks open a can of chili to heat in the microwave. The Swayzes are part of what Amazon calls its camper force. Every fall, hundreds of mostly retired folks drive to Campbellsville to work the holiday season. Amazon pays for their campsites and covers their electricity.
Right now, we're about a week or two away from leaving, so everybody's hunkered down and staying warm.
But they're excited, too, because there's an excitement that builds up as you start getting closer to the finish.
Karen is 57, Steve 55. They served for 20 years in the Army. Karen in military intelligence, Steve in transportation and logistics.
I decided some years back that I was going to work really hard half my life, not quite work as hard the other half.
So 10 years ago, they retired from the military, packed up their trailer, and hit the road.
We did like 39 states the first time we had it out, and that's when we found out how addictive it was.
That's also when they found out about Work Camper, a website that matches RV travelers with seasonal jobs. In the spring and summer, they mostly work at campgrounds or resorts. In the fall, they come to Amazon. This is their seventh season. General Manager Carlos De La Garza says the program started in 2010 as a novel way to staff the holiday rush.
Many of them are like former professionals in their own right, folks who were teachers, people who held leadership roles.
This year, Steve is working as a picker. Wearing a blue T-shirt and shorts, he pushes a cart down a long aisle between two rows of metal shelves and scans a toy bound for who knows where.
Thomas the Train. Everybody knows Thomas.
After he fills up a yellow bin, he'll deposit it on a conveyor belt that snakes through the warehouse to the packing stations, where Karen slides a light-up Christmas sweater into a plastic shipping pouch.
You basically just throw it on, and there it goes.
The pay starts at $11.50 an hour, plus time and a half for overtime. They work until a few days before Christmas, and then, flush with cash, head to Florida.
And we just live large down there, like a grand vacation for 3 or 4 months before we start doing something else again.
That same adventurous spirit inspired Annette and Don Bordeaux from Minnesota to retire early after careers in law enforcement and the travel industry.
Don and I tend to be why not people.
With Don's pension, they don't really need to work.
You know, retirement is really boring. You have to keep on moving. And that's what we're doing with this lifestyle.
It's not just retirees. Lindsay and Greg Johannesson are in their 40s and doing their first stint at Amazon. They left behind a house in Charlotte to tour the country with their 4 homeschooled kids.
We wanted to leave a legacy for our children of making memories and being able to travel and see the United States together as a family.
They've harvested sugar beets in North Dakota. After Amazon, they'll work a rodeo and livestock show in Houston.
Definitely enough work to keep it going.
Yep, 100%.
When their shift ends at 5 o'clock, Steve and Karen Swayze head back to their home on wheels. They walk their pug, Maggie, to the campground office to check their mail. A couple of Christmas packages await them with a familiar logo. What's the name of that place again?
I believe it came from Amazon. Amazon Prime. Love it.
Who knows, Steve says. He may have even processed the order. In Campbellsville, Kentucky, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, personnel division, two interesting changes today. John Schnatter announced he is stepping down as the CEO of his company this afternoon. Who is John Schnatter, I hear you saying? You've seen him on TV, I'm sure, usually alongside Peyton Manning shilling Papa John's pizza. Schnatter, a couple of months ago, blamed lousy pizza sales figures on the whole NFL kneeling issue. Also, Eric Schmidt is leaving the job as chairman of the board at Google's parent company, Alphabet. Schmidt, you might remember, was brought in to be the adult in the room back in 2001 as CEO before Google honestly became a verb, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 55 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ added 4 points, less than a tenth. S&P 500 up 5, about 0.2% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. John Gordon is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.